Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you.
My guest this week is Rick Smith. Rick is the Chief Executive Officer of Axon Enterprise, a pioneer in less lethal weapons and a global market leader in law enforcement technology. Rick founded the company, formerly known as Taser, in 1993 with a mission of protecting life. The company has since expanded its focus from the eponymous electroshock weapon to an ecosystem of integrated hardware and software ranging from body-worn cameras used by the majority of major U.S. police departments to a cloud-based evidence management system. Rick is also the author of a new book, The End of Killing: How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem. Rick graduated from Harvard University with a bachelor's degree in neuroscience and received an MBA from the University of Chicago. In this interview, Rick shares his entrepreneurship journey and details how Axon has pursued its mission to protect life without taking life. The company began by selling tasers to consumers as a way to incapacitate a threat without hurting others. However, when that failed to gain traction, the company began selling the weapon to police officers, which proved to be a tremendous success. Later, the company pivoted to selling body-worn cameras backed by the cloud as a way to protect police officers and increase transparency between law enforcement and the public. We also discuss the future of facial recognition and artificial intelligence in law enforcement, the Policing Technology Ethics Board the company has developed, themes from Rick's new book, and a variety of other topics. Rick Smith, welcome to Technovation. Great to speak with you today.
It's fantastic to speak with you. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. Well, Rick, I thought we'd begin with the genesis story of your company back in the early 90s. I know from having heard you speak about it previously, that it came from a conversation you had in Europe and during that time period about gun violence and a reflection upon how gun violence had touched your life. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind taking a moment to just describe that scenario.
Yeah, so two of my high school football teammates were shot and killed in what was just an argument that started at a red light and spun out of control and ended in the parking lot of a local golf resort. And when I was living in Europe, talking with some of the European students, they had this really dim view of America because of everything they'd seen in the news about gun violence. And as I was trying to tell them, well, it's really not that bad, one of them asked me if I knew anyone who'd been shot and killed. And in that moment, I had that realization that, yeah, I did. And that led to some soul searching and frankly, just a bit of frustration when I learned that 40,000 people are shot and killed every year in the United States. So I was far from alone in having, had acquaintances who'd been through some tragedy like this. And it struck me as I was thinking about this and reading about the problem that, everybody tends to focus on political solutions. You know, will the government, pass a law that saves us all? And that's proved to be extraordinarily difficult in this space. And we haven't had a ton of success. So as I looked at it, I realized, well, the way that humanity typically solves difficult problems is through innovation. And I'm not just talking about tech like, smartphones, et cetera, but I mean, think all the way back from like medieval times to the invention of sewage systems and aqueducts and, getting clean water and ultimately, healthcare and transportation. Technology shifts have been the primary driver that have lifted the human condition. And so as I looked at it, I realized that the technology we're using for self-defense is really a medieval technology. It's hundreds of years old of basically firing small lead projectiles at people. And that's an area that we could overhaul technologically and give people the ability to protect themselves and not have to kill someone in the process.
And how did you find the taser technology, something invented by Jack Cover, somebody you ultimately, I suppose, came into touch with and licensed the patents from? What was the leap from this insight to beginning an entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, so I started, like many entrepreneurs or many technologists, inspired by science fiction, right? You think about the world today, and then, man, you could imagine, if we had Captain Kirk's phaser from Star Trek, the very idea of shooting bullets at people would seem just completely outdated. And then you start to work backwards and, okay, what technologies are out there today? So I did a market survey. You know, there's pepper spray, there's batons. And I came across this taser device, which immediately resonated with me. My undergraduate degree was in neurobiology. And I was putting together a matrix of what technologies could you use to incapacitate a human being. And if you go through that analysis, electricity actually pops to the top relatively quickly, because if you want to, basically, if you want to incapacitate someone without hurting them, what you really want to do is just paralyze their nervous system for a period of time so you don't have to break their bones like with a baton or kill them like you would with a gun. You've got approaches like pepper spray that, you know, use pain, but pain doesn't stop somebody. If you really want to stop them, you need to take out their control. And electricity has some properties that just make it really good. It's got a very high safety margin. It's an immediate effect from when an electric current is applied to a person. And it turns out this NASA scientist had already had this idea back in the 1960s and 70s. And when I came across articles about the taser weapon, I then did some patent searches to learn more. And in the course of that, I discovered the inventor was living in Tucson, Arizona, near where my parents lived. And so literally, I just dialed 411, got his phone number. For those people, the younger audience may not know, 411 is like, you know, before Google, you would call a phone company to get, you know, to get somebody's number. And so I just called him out of the blue and said, hey, I'm fascinated with what you've done with this taser weapon. But at that point, it had been a commercial failure. And he was retired and he was quite frustrated at the time that his invention hadn't taken off. And I went down and I was 23 years old. He was 73 and we hit it off immediately. And we were kind of like the odd couple where the two of us started another company's garage, and he was mentoring me and teaching me all the technology. And I was focusing on how we would ultimately build a business. I'm more of an entrepreneur than an inventor. So that's what I think made us a powerful combination. And frankly, one of the reasons maybe that it hadn't succeeded previously is he was very focused on building the technology, but you know, ultimately technology is a piece of the puzzle, but you need sales, you need manufacturing, right? You've got to build a team that can do all the things it takes to build a business. And that's, I think, what ultimately made us successful once we came together.
Well, it's interesting. You obviously found a way to success, but actually most of the first decade was quite a long slog that, you know, at certain points, as I understand it, you were worried for a very good reason this was not going to be a success. In fact, I've heard you also talk about the worry that you might, you know, financially ruin your parents, who'd been very generous in loaning you money and being financial contributors to your entrepreneurial journey as well. What was the pivot? And as I say, this was not an overnight success. It took some time. So what happened that would ultimately get this on the right track?
Yeah, so we did. We wiped my parents out completely. I mean, it got dicey. So we started in 93, and 6 years later in 1999, I thought our chance of success was near zero. It was very dark. But I had no choice at that point because my parents had literally put everything they had into the company. And my dad had signed a note that we'd borrowed from the bank. So if we went under, they would have wiped him out. Now, what happened was, so our first product we launched in the consumer space, and it was a failure. We then pivoted and we tried doing an automotive security product. And that was the biggest mistake I've ever made. When your first product, it turns out, isn't right and you don't find product market fit, it's really tempting to just try something else and look for a silver bullet. And that's what we did with our second product, which was also a disaster because we tried to pivot into a different industry. And then in the dark moment when we realized we were 0-for-2 and we were running out of cash, we had that moment where you look in the mirror and say, okay, why did we start this business? Like, what's the problem we want to solve? Let's forget about making money. Like, what's our value contribution to the world? And so we returned back to, okay, if we're going to create weapons that will save lives, we're going to need to pivot into the professional market with police because there's a ton of credibility issues. Consumers thought it was just a gimmick. And so we basically determined, all right, we've got to get the technology right. And that means we've got to prove it with a professional user base. So we pivoted and we went into law enforcement. And that actually forced us to go deep in the product and determine what wasn't working and what we needed to fix. And the biggest problem was early generation tasers were underpowered. if you had an aggressive subject, the early generation tasers wouldn't stop them. And famously, an LAPD taser failed to stop Rodney King. Now, that was not a weapon we made. That was actually from Jack the Inventor's first attempt at the company in the 70s. But it was illustrative of the problem that we had to solve getting the device to be truly effective. So we did the hard work in 97 and 98, 99, as we were trying to solve that problem. And then we pivoted. And when we entered law enforcement, the main thing that we did in the pivot was literally fixing the product so it delivered on its promise, which is when you deploy it, when you fire this at somebody, they're going to go down. And once we solved that problem, once we got the product in the market, it literally just took off. And between early 2000 and 2004, we grew from about under $2 million a year of sales to almost $70 million a year of sales in just 4 years. It's like a 35-fold increase.
Incredible. And in fact, you mentioned in the late 90s, you thought the chances of success were near zero. And it was just a couple years later that you would go public, in fact. So an extraordinary turnaround in a very quick amount of time.
It was amazing. When I first started the business, I think all entrepreneurs, you have this like delusional sense of how easy it's going to be. And then, the dark days set in and you realize, oh, crap, like this is hard. And then it got harder and it got worse. And then there was a moment where my recommendation was actually to shut the company down at one point. And literally it was because my dad, as I was explaining this to him, I'm trying to tell him not to put any more money in. And he said, man, that ship has sailed. Like anything I've got left is less than we owe the bank. So failure now is total and complete. And that was a sobering moment where you realize, okay, all right, we got to figure this out.
Yeah, very interesting. And it was in the next decade after going public, after this tremendous success that you highlighted in the first half of the 2000s, that you had yet another pivot in 2008, and through a strategy session determined that rather than simply being a manufacturer of one technology, the company should be the technologists of law enforcement worldwide. Can you talk a bit about that transition? Not necessarily one doesn't necessarily follow from the other with kind of immediate logic, despite the fact that obviously that insight has proven to be quite wise since. How did that come about?
Yeah, so let me start with the failure that preceded that success. So we've talked about the pivot in 99, and then boom, the company takes off. We then went through a phase where we're like, okay, we are a taser technology company. So what other markets could we sell tasers into? So we're being very technology driven. And so we built a long-range taser that was fired from a shotgun. And we built a military taser weapon that was like a Claymore mine that you could set up near a checkpoint. And if somebody came into the zone and you needed to stop them, you could deploy it remotely. And those products turned out to be real failures. And in retrospect, it's because we had a technology and we were trying to figure out who we could go sell it to. And the world is full of stories of how that strategy can fail. And so we had to do some soul searching that, well, wait a minute. Taking our technology and trying to package it for other industries, doesn't seem to be working. Some of those industries may not actually need our technology. But if we go back and we look at our core customers, they have this incredibly strong need for something to help protect them when they use the taser. So there's this adjacent problem that when police use a taser, they often get sued or they're in the media getting accused of doing bad things to people. And so we realized, well, what if we continued to pull the thread and shift from being internally technology driven to being customer driven, which sounds kind of cliche, but for us, it was, very material where we pivoted and we said, okay, instead of trying to sell our tech to more people, let's solve more problems for our existing customers. So we launched cameras, body cameras to help protect police by recording these incidents so they could show people why they did what they did. And then the body cameras led to another problem, which is, what are our customers going to do with all the data that would come off of these cameras? And we ultimately made a decision that we would pivot and create a cloud software back end. Basically, it was a bit of iTunes, iPod inspiration, right? Where Apple entered the crowded space, famously, of music players, and they won by combining the software and the hardware together. We basically said, okay, our industry looks sort of like the music player industry in the late 90s. There were lots of in-car cameras. Now, body cameras were relatively new. And but we saw this as a transition point where not only could we add a camera to our repertoire, but we could add high-value software to manage all the data. And that turned out to be a very difficult transition again. I think I probably underestimated the difficulty of transitioning the company from a manufacturing company to a integrated hardware software company. But it's been obviously highly successful now, where we've significantly grown the company. And now the software and sensors, namely the cameras and software, are as large as the TASER business, and it's growing much faster than the TASER business.
Very interesting. And can you talk a bit about a comparison of, so now you've got this sort of portfolio of products that law enforcement can use, each of them integrated with the other, you know, drawing information from the hardware up to the cloud for better analysis, recording, you know, the evidence and so on. Now actually getting further into artificial intelligence. I wonder, Rick, if you could take a moment and talk about the way in which policing has traditionally been done, and then sort of contrasting it with your vision for how it will be done, how it is currently being done, in fact, using your solutions, so sort of holding those side by side.
Yeah, so I would say one of the insights that we had around the time we were making this pivot from being internal tech-driven to customer needs-driven, we realized that in order for us to succeed, we couldn't invent every technology our customers would need. That would be impractical. So we basically landed on a strategy that said, well, how can we look at trends that are happening in other industries and how we could leverage those technology trends in our industry? And so one of those being the cloud. So in 2008, 2009, the idea of using the cloud for business applications had already taken off, right? Salesforce was growing, Amazon in the consumer space, it was really disrupting retail. And when we took a look at our market, it's highly fragmented. There's 18,000 police departments in the U.S., and they're all agencies of your local city government. So it actually makes it very difficult for them to implement technology on their own. They've got this really convoluted purchasing process that's highly bureaucratic, very slow moving, does not allow for mistakes. Like a lot of times with tech, you'll try something, it doesn't work. You have to pivot and try something else. For local government, that's nearly impossible because every procurement cycle can take a year or two. And then the political backlash if something fails and going in a different direction, you know, usually means the people who made the last call lose their job. So there's very little agility. And as we looked at those characteristics, we realized, well, we should shift the whole technology delivery model. Instead of our customers buying technology and figuring it out, you know, servers and software and setting up their own like data centers, we can take advantage of this trend that's happening in the rest of the world, where all these other industries are moving to this centralized cloud-hosted model, where your technology provider delivers your software and even connected hardware, where it uses the internet and that provider actually provides the functioning service. We all, you know, see that in spades now as consumers, where, you know, you buy an Alexa, plug it in your kitchen and you're live with all sorts of crazy awesome services that you didn't have to figure out how to set up. That same model was already happening in 2008 and 2009 in the private enterprise space. And the big bet that we made was that we could use this internet-enabled delivery model to create a whole ecosystem of both hardware and software devices that would enable us to deliver capabilities much more rapidly to our customers. And then since they wouldn't have to worry about, you know, installing software upgrades, et cetera, we could dramatically accelerate their pace of tech adoption. And that's worked out, frankly, just beautifully, where our customers love it, where once they get on our subscription plans, you know, we're upgrading their cameras every 2.5 years. We're upgrading their software monthly. And then as we roll out new software capabilities, they can buy new services from us and it integrates seamlessly with what they're already using. So it dramatically decreases the time and energy for them to deploy new capabilities. And so whereas 10 years ago, police agencies were largely driven by forms on paper, and if they did have video cameras, they were recording on VHS tapes. We now have, all of our customers have these cloud-connected audio-video sensors, and we're launching a whole host of software platforms where our real advantage would be long-term is that our data systems will be primarily sensor-driven rather than human-driven. Meaning today, a police officer spends over half their time writing reports. Well, we already have audio-video sensors the cop is wearing that's recording these incidents. That's a far better record than any paper report that officer could write. But a video is unstructured data. You can't just take a video and put it through a business process. So we're using artificial intelligence, machine learning, combined with our new software offerings so that we can extract the metadata from the audio-video record rather than having a cop sit at the keyboard typing all day. And we think within the next 5 years, we will largely automate the whole report creation process to where officers will be spending very little time writing reports. Instead, a police report will be an audio-video experience where we're automatically transcribing what happened and helping the officer, you know, they can quickly dictate a synopsis and we can extract, you know, names, places, identities, key events, and largely automate the entire information management backend of policing. And the punchline for our customers means we could effectively double the world's police force just by eliminating the 50% of their time that's spent on non-value-added bureaucracy today. And we'll do that through a combination of our cloud-connected sensors, our cloud software, and AI.
Very interesting. In your new book, a book that came out in May of 2019, The End of Killing, How Our Newest Technologies Can Solve Humanity's Oldest Problem, in which, of course, you talk in some at some length about some of the very themes we're talking about here, you articulate, as you have before, your mission, of course, to protect life, and your long-term objectives to obsolete the bullet, reduce social conflict, and enable a fair and effective justice system. Do you feel like you're talking about the kind of new vision for the next 5 years? Do you feel like adequate progress will be made across all three of those long-term objectives in the coming half decade?
Oh, for sure. I could not be excited. I think most of what we've been doing so far has been foundational, building the network, building the infrastructure, getting the, you know, the cops to wear the cameras and the data into the cloud where we can work with it. If we think about those three objectives, I mean, the reason I wrote the book, it's my manifesto, right? Like, you know, Elon Musk is a brilliant technologist and his manifesto is to get us to Mars. Mine is how do we get to a planet where people just don't kill each other here anymore? And technology can play a huge role in that, starting with advanced non-lethal weapons. I've set the goal that in the next 10 years, we will have non-lethal weapons that outperform police guns, police handguns. And that's going to be a game changer because right now police, they're not legally authorized to be an executioner. When they kill someone, it is not because they're out to kill that person. When they do it, it's because today lethal force is the only truly reliable and effective way to stop a critical threat. But that's not going to be true much longer. We believe, and I had meetings this past week with our product development group, we've got pretty clear line of sight to how we can actually outperform lethal force, so where you can stop somebody faster without killing them than by punching holes in them with a bullet. And then the other things we talked about there, bringing transparency to policing. Well, that's already happening with these body cameras. We're getting a lot more insight. There's far fewer cases where police kill someone and there's a he said, she said, right? That we're, most of the time now there's a video that can be released. And so we can see whether the police were acting rationally or not. And then this last piece about making the justice system more fair. That's why I also wrote the book to take on a lot of these controversial issues around artificial intelligence and facial recognition. These are kind of scary technologies and they could be misused, but they could also be used to really make our justice system much more fair, much more efficient. And so, you know, I think we need to get past the initial, well, wait a minute, are the police going to turn us into China where we're using face tracking to track every citizen every minute of the day? We actually just came out this week. Our AI ethics board had come out with recommendations that we not deploy face recognition today on body cameras, and we're restraining from doing so. But I do lay out a vision in the book that face recognition technology does have a role to play in the future of policing. We just have to move carefully to make sure it doesn't get abused and that it's sufficiently accurate and not biased before we start to use it. So punchline is all these controversial technologies, the answer is not going to be a simple yes or no. Police can use it. No, they can't. It's going to be nuanced around okay, what sorts of controls are in place? How can we actually use this technology to make communities safer, but do it in a way that doesn't, you know, throw everybody's privacy away? And these are really exciting problems to work on because they're going to have a huge impact as we roll out different tech solutions over the next decade.
It's very interesting. You referenced the AI and Policing Technology Ethics Board that you've created to ensure that as AI advances continue, that they do so with ethics in mind. How have you developed this this ethics board? How have you populated it, and what sort of a mandate have you given them?
Yeah, so we started by frankly doing a media scan of who were some of the more critical voices of policing, and particularly some of the technologies we knew we'd be using. So we brought in some sort of groups that tend to be more focused on police oversight. So Barry Friedman from NYU, who's a constitutional lawyer and professor who runs the NYU Policing Project. And then we brought in members from the EFF, although the EFF did not formally join. We have people representing their organization informally on the board. And then we brought in community groups representing communities of color, including both communities and law enforcement. The National Organization of Black Law Enforcement is on our board. We brought in some academics with expertise in AI, Miles Brundage from the Future of Humanity Institute, and then a couple of police chiefs. So we wanted to get a good, we had to have some police on the board to represent our customers' interests, but I'd say we calibrated the board 75% towards civil liberties-oriented groups. And then we did put a lot of thought into, like, is this going to be a board of governance that can, like, have veto power over our roadmap? And we decided not to go that direction, because if we did, then we'd have to focus on kind of gerrymandering our own board to make sure that, you know, its interests would align with ours. And then you get to a point, well, if it's always going to agree with us, why have a board? So we made a decision, and we're very transparent, and the board agreed with this, that we want a board that's going to challenge our thinking. And that means we're not always going to agree. So the board does not get veto power over the company's roadmap. However, it is going to be very influential, because I can tell you it's going to be a difficult situation for us if our board is making one recommendation publicly and we're doing something else. We're going to have made sure that we very carefully understand all the issues, before we would proceed with something our board does not agree with. But ultimately, I think that's what will make the board powerful, is that we've intentionally chose one that is not aligned with our traditional core market interests in law enforcement, but is more aligned with some of the groups that are impacted by law enforcement. And we think that's the right way to make sure we're getting, you know, people that are challenging our thinking to make us better.
Excellent. Well, Rick Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Technovation today, sharing a bit about your entrepreneurial journey, your vision for the future, and how technology can solve, as you say, humanity's oldest problem. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks. Yeah, it's pretty invigorating to think, you know, we're working towards a world where it's no longer acceptable for people to kill each other. And, that's a really empowering and invigorating mission to work on. And indeed, thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be the best-selling author, Malcolm Gladwell.